Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
And welcome to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, and today's guest is Michael Silhavy. Michael, welcome.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
It is very good to have you here. Michael lives now in Chicago. I first met him in the Diocese of Minneapolis-St. Paul, where he was the director of music for the entire diocese, directed the Archdiocesan Choir. He was the king of music in all of Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Hardly.
No, not true, not true. He was amazing, is amazing. But now you have a brand new title. I can't even imagine how much responsibility. You are senior editor of the GIA Publications. Now, in the old days, I'm old enough to remember it being the Gregorian Institute of America, but it is now just called GIA Publications, and you're the head honcho.
Well, I'm part of a good team, but thanks for that gracious intro.
You are the head honcho. You are the one that makes the decision whether something gets published or not, correct?
Yeah, there is a team of us that review. We get several thousand pieces of music a year.
I can't imagine it.
And the winnowing process, it's quite intense. So obviously with several thousand pieces submitted, we only get to publish a fraction of that. And within that fraction, we're trying to reach out to the diversity that, first of all, is the Catholic Church, both in terms of styles and difficulty, but also the fact that we have ethnicity.
Right.
We also have a large Protestant and secular following for our music also.
Exactly. So, you know, textbooks, choral books. GIA is a huge company with divisions in education and sacred music, right?
Right, yeah. It started about 75 years ago in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh, where I was. I was there celebrating your anniversary at one point when I was still the director of music in Pittsburgh.
Initially developed to promote Gregorian chant and proper music and Catholic worship in the 40s and 50s, and since we've grown to be much more diverse. And so we shortened the name to GIA to kind of disguise the chant heritage, but also still honor it and maintain it.
Yeah, yeah, it's wonderful. And of course, you succeed people like Bob Battistini and others who have gone before you. Certainly one of the great editors in that company, one of the great choral people was Richard Prue. And that's the other part of what we're going to talk about today on Music from the Tower is the great man Richard Prue. So we're going to kind of do a little show to honor Richard today. But before we leave Michael Silhavy, I want to talk a little bit more about what it's like to publish music in the Catholic Church. You've already hit the nail on the head. This is a church with so many things. Somebody who works in Southern California gets it in spades. We've got Spanish. We've got Vietnamese. We've got Samoans. We've got Filipinos. We've got everything possible down here. And, of course, we're a cathedral at Christ Cathedral, so we must maintain the whole treasury of our fabulous repertoire that dates back all the way to Palestrina. So how do you do all that in a publishing way? Do you just publish new stuff and hope that people grab the old stuff? How do you balance all that? I can't even begin to fathom it.
Well, I think one of the curses and the blessings is we develop trust among church musicians that they can look to GIA for this type of music. Now, in the Catholic world, I think we're seen as the folks who do hardbound hymnals, our chant offerings, a large body of people writing hymn texts for the liturgy. But also, we certainly are offering the church the music of the composers writing after the Second Vatican Council, what we used to call the folk tradition, the folk choir, maybe now lyric contemporary. And in addition to that, we continue to expand and look for new areas that need help in developing and promoting a repertoire that is theirs. We're very proud of our African-American church music series, and we also have quite a bit of music in world church offerings and selection. So the good news is we focus and always try to better what we have, but we're always on the lookout for trying to respond to needs of communities throughout the United States. And we can't always adequately address those needs, but we continue to work on that. And quite honestly, we also partner in an unofficial way with some of our publisher colleagues, where maybe we do some things better than others, and maybe others might do some things better to us. So we're torn between if the needs of the church are being met by us or with others, that's a good thing. So,
well, the good news for GIA is they've got somebody who's an incomparable musician at the helm of the deal. You know, I think that's a big plus is to have, and I think all the publishers are moving in that direction of having really fine musicians look that over. It's a very difficult process. I just know as a cathedral musician, as a diocesan director of music in former diocese, people would send me scores all the time, you know, and some are amazing, and some are in 3-3 time, you know. They just don't have the musical skills to write, but everybody thinks they've got a little tune somewhere in their
right.
head, you know. And so sifting through all of that must have been amazing. I just think about a few years ago when we changed our mass texts. Everybody and their brother was writing new mass settings. Now, finally, after a couple years, the halfway decent ones are beginning to surface to the top. And the others are falling away. But every parish musician was writing their own. And how do you build a national repertoire when we've got really three competing companies who put out hymnals, who have missalettes, who have all these things? And whatever that parish has is what the parish knows as repertoire. So it's not a Catholic repertoire. It's a GIA repertoire or an OCP repertoire. Or a World Library repertoire. And we as church musicians have to sift through all that. And we're kind of lucky here at Christ Cathedral because we use screens. Now, don't fall over, Radioland snobby musicians. This snobby musician arrived going, oh, I don't think I'll ever use those. I couldn't live without those puppies. They are amazing because I can put up there and people that wouldn't touch a worship sheet or ever consider opening a hymnal cannot stop looking at the screen. So they might not be singing, but they're still following along. It's just something about our American psyche about looking at a screen and following along. But it's also great not to have to fight at weddings to put music in a program and how do you get the Gloria? It just pops on the screen. And our participation here is amazing because of it. But so that means I have the choice of choosing repertoire from everywhere. We don't have a hymnal. It's just on screen. But those are people who are really bound to a hymnal, whether it's GIA or anybody else. They know that repertoire. And so the sharing among publishers must be a little tricky.
It is. You know, there is a good amount of sharing in resources by different copyright holders. And we do sometimes run the risk of making a publisher a denomination or a loyalty. And that can be a little bit awkward or difficult. And I think we should be careful of that, where one says, I'm a GIA person, or I'm an OCP person, or I'm a World Library person. But
and don't begin to investigate what the other holdings are.
Right.
I have a small choral series in Morningstar Publisher, you know, and it's primarily geared to difficult music for cathedral liturgies, but it plays to everyone, you know. It just kind of goes across the board of it's good choral music, and good music is good music regardless of the style, or if it's in Spanish or if it's in Vietnamese. If it's good quality music, it deserves a look. So how do you determine what's good quality music? How do you make that determination?
Yeah, believe it or not, it starts with the texts. Of the thousands of the things we open up, some of them never make it to the actual music desk on the piano just because of the quality of the text. And I think that's an important thing for folks to consider as they're worshiping on Sundays, that even though there is something so immediate and attractive and uplifting or supportive of the music itself, us musicians first need to be people of the text. You know, it said we've got that awesome responsibility of putting words in people's mouths.
Right, exactly. And theology in people's mouths.
Correct. So the most wonderful piece of music, the most perfectly constructed piece of music, the most engaging, uplifting, consoling, if the text doesn't support the liturgy, the liturgical year, the scriptures, or isn't
or indeed
Catholic theology. It's just not, doesn't even make it for review. So first, it's about the text. And then secondly, of course, the music needs to exhibit compositional craft. Is the melody in a comfortable range for a congregation? Is the keyboard part idiomatic of piano or organ or whatever the accompanying instruments are?
Does it require more than 10 fingers?
Exactly.
You know, people write things on Finale, and it's like, okay, I can't play that, you know?
And then what we would call the craft of the choral writing, the voice leading. Is it intuitive for the choir so they know where their notes are going to go? And then is it practical? Is it something that requires the sopranos divided into 9 parts? Well, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
we need to find music that is addressing the reality of performance.
Who's really making music?
Who's making
in this
the music?
Church. Yeah, exactly. And for me, as I look at music, piles and piles of music that continues to come from every publisher and everywhere, can it sustain the repetition of liturgy? You know, I mean, you pop in the CD, maybe you're driving somewhere and you're going through 12 choral packets, and you have a nice long drive and you're listening to something and you go, wow, that's really beautiful. Wow, that's really wonderful. And you go and buy it, and about the third Sunday through this new Sanctus or new Holy Holy, you can't stand it anymore. You
know,
it just, it doesn't make it in the sustaining repetition of our Catholic liturgy.
And this is something that's, I think, key for us in liturgical churches, and one of the things we wrestle with as a publisher, probably philosophically because of our liturgical and theological training. We believe in the Roman Catholic tradition and other liturgical traditions that there is something wonderful about these, for instance, set lectionary readings we come back to year after year. So the way a woman who is pregnant experiences the Advent readings the year she's pregnant is far different than other years. Or to encounter the raising of Lazarus after losing a loved one is very powerful. The same with music. We perhaps believe in a somewhat fixed repertoire, these touch tones pieces that we want to sing. We want to sing David Haas's Blessed Are They when the Beatitudes are read in church. So how do we honor that tension between having this music that's part of us, part of our bones, part of our memories, experience, but also introducing new
something
music.
New.
So it's this tension.
I think of Christmas, for example. How does a piece break into the Christmas repertoire when you can barely get in all the Christmas songs that everybody already wants to sing? Because that piece sounds, tastes, touches, feels, everything else, all about Christmas. And now here comes this whole pile of new Christmas pieces that somehow, and boy, to break into a repertoire like that is a tough, it's got to be sensational. I think of a little piece like Before the Marvel of This Night by Carl Schalk, or just a couple of Christmas pieces that somehow have done, the Even So Lord Jesus Quickly Come of Paul Mons, a couple pieces that have somehow inserted themselves into a very set repertoire. It's pretty amazing. Well, one of the guys we're going to talk about today is our good friend, both of us, dear Richard Prue, our dearly departed friend. But certainly, his music has not departed. He is going to be part of the Catholic fabric of music making, and beyond Catholic, but certainly Catholic, for generations,
correct,
I believe. And we're going to talk a lot about Richard in the next few segments, but we better hear a piece. We're going to hear his very first piece, right, Michael?
Yeah, so the first piece I brought is entitled Jesu, the Very Thought of Thee. And it was written somewhere around the tender age of 17 or 18, published in 1959. And it was dedicated to one of his organ teachers, Dr. Rupert Surkamp, in the Twin Cities. It is an unabashedly romantic piece of music, maybe in the British cathedral style, based on a melody that is indicative, imitative of a plainchant melody. And it's a setting of the well-known text by Bernard of Clairvaux, Jesu, the very thought of thee.
And this is Richard conducting his cathedral singers?
This is Richard conducting his cathedral singers. This was a group of singers who began life as his paid section leaders at the Holy Name Cathedral in Chicago. And later on, they began to do some commercial recordings. And that's the group we're going to hear in Jesu, the very thought of thee.
And we will be right back with a whole lot more from Michael Silhavy and a whole lot more about our dear friend Richard Prue. Please stay tuned. This is Music from the Tower.
You're listening to Music from the Tower on Relevant Radio.
Underwritten by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Orange.
This is John Romero, Music Director at Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. We are 1 year away from the dedication of our beautiful cathedral, and we have some spectacular concerts available to you. Check them all out at ChristCathedralMusic.org or on our Facebook page, Christ Cathedral Music. We'd love to see you here.
Christ Cathedral Concerts, great music in a sacred place. For tickets, visit ChristCathedralMusic.org.
Welcome back. You've just enjoyed a wonderful piece by Richard Prue, Jesu, the very thought of thee. And now we're going to spend the rest of our time together visiting with our guest today from Chicago, Michael Silhavy. Michael is the senior editor of the GIA Corporation, and certainly many, many, not all, but many, many of Richard's pieces were published through the GIA. And you have just done a study of his archives or his life, or tell us how you came to be connected to Richard.
Yeah, well, first of all, as a young church musician growing up in Chicago, when Richard was at the Cathedral
of Holy Name,
of Cathedral Holy Name in Chicago, the influence and the example he set was just infectious to all of us, much in the same way the model of a cathedral music program that he developed there really became a model for cathedrals throughout the country.
Well, so that serving was my, in four cathedrals, let me tell you, all my thought is constantly, what would Richard do? Or if I didn't like something and I got stuck doing it, I go, you know, Richard Prue would never play this piece or never sing this piece. I always used Richard as the model. We all did.
Exactly. So I knew Richard from those days. I also knew Richard from a little stint I did at GIA from 1985 to 1990, when I was in Chicago going to school, you had earlier mentioned the name Bob Battistini. I grew up in Bob's Parish.
Wow.
And the reason I'm
We're all connected.
Yeah. But then my real intense work with Richard began. I was doing a class paper for one of my courses at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, kind of one of the premier schools for Roman Catholic liturgy, liturgical studies, liturgical music. And I submitted a little class paper on the hymn tunes of Richard Prue. That meant I had to do a little reconnecting with Richard, getting the stories of the hymns, how they came to be. We then strayed into talking about some anthems and mass settings. My thesis project ended up being a survey of all his work, and the result ended up being the Richard Prue collection at the Alcuin Library in Collegeville, where all of Richard's published and a good number of his manuscripts are all housed in one location. Church musicians like yourself know that your files are probably filled with little pieces of music that Richard wrote for you at your request or pieces he gave away. So I'm not sure we'll ever be able to gather all of Richard's music in one location. But that's my connection with Richard. And we worked together for about 10 years.
Even to have the collection up at St. John's is such a gift. Somebody like Richard, I know he gave all of his organ music to Duquesne while I was teaching here in Pittsburgh, which was a great gift to that. I mean, some treasures of organ things long since unpublished. But to have Richard's work, Richard was at the Chicago Cathedral for a good many years, and we're going to talk about that a little later, but he really began his career in Minneapolis.
Yeah, Minneapolis, the Twin Cities have always had a rich church music life. I want to think it might be because of the influence of St. John's Abbey, about 80 miles northwest of the Twin Cities, as well as the Lutheran college tradition.
Yeah, it's right there.
The Lutheran, the Scandinavian tradition, and the population of the Twin Cities, it's always been a singing tradition, and I think that filtered into Catholic churches, even in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Richard was at a fortunate to be at a unique church growing up as a young high school student and later young adult. This church, the Church of the Holy Childhood in St. Paul, was one of the parishes, one of the few parishes, that was given the opportunity to experience, to experiment with the revised rites of Holy Week that Pius XII and the folks in the Vatican offices were developing in the 1950s. So folks would be good to remember that the Holy Week liturgies as we know them now were really non-existent prior to the Council. The blessing of the Paschal Candle probably took place in the rectory office on a Saturday morning.
Right. All the things we've just come to know as Holy Week, the Mandatum, all those things.
So here's Richard watching these things being done. Here's Richard participating. And then later Richard
15 years before any of
right,
us.
Right. Composing for some of these. So it was a wonderful place for him to grow up. He was there as a young high school student playing the organ. He then worked with a fellow named Bruce Larson, a legendary Twin Cities musician. And then Richard later became music director at the Church of the Holy Childhood in St. Paul, Minnesota. A wonderful liturgical and music tradition. It maintained the tradition of a choir of men and boys, but it was performing the newer music, some American premieres of music by Benjamin Britten, and absolutely singing the newest and best music being written for the Reformed liturgy of a more classical choral organ bass style.
Which certainly wasn't happening anywhere in America in the 50s, yeah.
So it was a very privileged place for him to grow up, and that spirit of experimentation and quality stayed with him throughout his whole compositional life.
And it reflected really in that very first piece. Imagine a 17, 18-year-old writing a piece of the quality of the Jesu, the very thought of thee. Well, let's hear another piece of music, shall we?
Right. Next, I have chosen Happy Are Those, which is a setting of Psalm 1. And this is a piece scored for children's choir. Musicians who are singing it or listening to this could also realize this might be able to be done by an adult choir. But there's something kind of childlike in its playfulness. A setting of Psalm 1. I brought this because it also speaks to the importance Richard believed in developing and working with children's choirs. He was an excellent pedagogue and teacher of children's choir music. And some of his pieces are actually choral exercises disguised as anthems. This piece here was very much about getting the kids to sing in thirds, which actually is sometimes harder than having the kids sing two independent lines. So it's a teaching piece disguised as an anthem, but as you'll hear, quite lovely and a beautiful orchestration with string quartet and flute and oboe.
Is this Richard conducting?
Once again, this is Richard conducting, and here he is using women from his cathedral singers, but you'll certainly enjoy their clear, childlike voices.
We'll be right back with a lot more from Michael Solhavy, and certainly a lot more about remembering our wonderful Richard Prue, composer to all of America. And we will be right back. This is Music from the Tower, and this is John Romero.
Thank you for listening to Music from the Tower on Relevant Radio.
Showing for one night only at a theater near you. A story about the devastating consequences of the sexual revolution and one father's quest for answers.
Have you seen the videos and Instagram posts and ads that young women are fed these days? It's craziness.
From writer-director Don Johnson, a new documentary that uncovers the truth about how we got here.
The gist of Cosmo was hard work and sex without the kids will set you free.
Unprotected, featuring stories and insight from some of today's most articulate Catholic thinkers, including Christopher West and Jennifer Fulweiler. Tickets available now at unprotectedmovie.com.
You are listening to Music from the Tower, and the music in the tower is by Richard Prue today on today's show. And this is Michael Solhavey here with me in the studio, remembering our dear friend Richard Prue. And we were just listening to a piece called He is the Way. Tell us about this piece, Michael.
Yeah, I brought this in because as we're kind of journeying through Richard's life, first in Minneapolis, now this is going to be my bridge piece to getting us talking about his time in Seattle. In the late 60s, he left the position at the Church of the Holy Childhood in St. Paul and headed out to the West Coast, specifically the Seattle-Tacoma area. And I think a couple things happened. The move out there really gave him a chance to focus a little bit more on composing. And the He is the Way, by no means is it a dissonant piece, but there are some wonderfully playful harmonies in this piece. And it's showing a little bit, perhaps, of some compositional experimentation. So he began to really start to develop a unique musical language during the late 60s, early 70s. Once again, I'm struck by the fact that he chose to set the well-known Auden text, He is the Way, He is the Truth, He is the Life, focusing again on, you know, that call for composers to really offer the church not only the best of music, but the best of texts. One of the reasons I think that Richard went out to Seattle would have been the chance to work with the legendary cathedral musician in the Episcopal Cathedral, St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle, Peter Halleck. Halleck, in his own tradition, was reminding people that plain chant and Gregorian melodies do have a place in a Reformed liturgy, whether it be Catholic or Episcopalian. Peter was influential in the revival of using liturgical handbells, having handbells accompany chant. So I think Richard saw in Peter an interesting mentor to help him both with his understanding of composition and also the recapturing of older forms, older styles, older instrumentations, and crafting them in a brand new setting. Richard worked in a number of parishes in the Seattle area, and it was there that he also wrote his community mass. Now, digging through the archives at GIA, I was happy to see the very first letter that Richard ever sent to GIA, his very first submission.
Oh, what a treasure.
And it was the very polite, Dear Sir or Madam, I am submitting my community mass for your consideration. And he noted, it seems to have done quite well in some local parishes here. And yes, indeed, the mass did more than quite well.
Because the mainstays in Catholic liturgy.
This also, once again, speaks to the fact that Richard was there writing for congregations, writing engaging music for congregations and choir. And the secret was it seems so simple, but in his community mass, when he sets the Lord have mercy to the Lord have mercy, and you think, well, is this new music? Why do I know this new music? Why is it so successful? Well, because it was the old melody from the Latin Litany of the Saints chant that we had been singing all our life. So he had a wonderful ability to take old melodies and simply reuse them in the most unsuspecting way, and it just created instant music for us all.
Fully orchestrated to the hilt with descants and all the like, and as simple as anything for any congregation. You know, I think I had already always credited Peter Halleck with his chant reigniting Richard into chant, and I'm so happy to hear you sort of confirm my, it was just a suspicion, because Peter himself has a lot of chant-based compositions, a lot of handbells use, and I always kind of thought, well, that's where Richard kind of came to that. But I had no proof of that whatsoever. So now the expert has told me that. Was he actually himself at St. Mark's Cathedral?
Richard, never in an official capacity, but he certainly helped out Meek and Music, you know, the well-known Compline series there at St. Mark's Cathedral and writing pieces for the Compline Choir. So it was never an official position of his, but certainly involved.
It was a very fruitful musical time. I mean, a whole pile of pieces from that period are just treasures. And you're right. There's compositional experimentation going on, isn't there? You know, you find him every now and then you think, is that Howells or is that Richard? You know, I think of there are a couple pieces like that that are really homage to Herbert Howells.
Right.
Because they're just moving through the minefield of chromaticism, chromatic notes.
He was free to admit he did what he called a little musical grave robbing and borrowing flavors and styles. Howells, Delius, very much also composing in French school. So,
exactly.
Yes.
Yes, Richard, I mean, he's an organ composer, instrumental music, mass settings, hymns. I think of Castleton, you know, that beautiful hymn tune he has for the hymn, creative hymn about the artists. There's so much in his little wheelhouse that is still part of our everyday language in the Catholic Church. It's just amazing. Let's listen to just a bit more music, because his biggest chapter is our Chicago bit. And I want to go back to that and also a little bit about the Madeline School, where he helped out in getting that off the ground. What should we listen to now?
Sure. Next, I've brought a piece called O Lord, Support Us. It's a setting of the well-known prayer by Cardinal John Henry Newman, the O Lord, Support Us All the Day Long. Now, I brought this because it goes back to that last point we were talking about, the fact Richard was writing for the liturgy, writing out of experience. Not every choir is able to do four-part music. Richard realized this, and he wrote to the reality of parish life. This is a beautiful piece for just two mixed voices, women and men. But this is not simplistic music. This is not music that a choir would feel less of because of singing. It is high-quality two-part music. And that's a real challenge, to do more with less. So,
well, I think it shows artistry of composition. You know, I think he, other composers like Leo Nestor, you know, had that capability of writing incredibly easy things, especially if there was a congregational line involved. But yet it's surrounded by this lush harmony and gorgeous, innovative accompaniments, harmonies, descants, and things to enhance those congregational simple melodies.
You mentioned Herbert Howells. I think you'll hear a little bit in this next piece. The O Lord, Support Us.
And this is also Cathedral Singers, Richard conducting.
Correct.
And this is Music from the Tower. And we are filled with the music of Richard Prue today here in the Tower. And delighted to have our guest, Michael Salehi from Chicago. Please stay tuned. We're about to go to Chicago, where Richard was the cathedral organist at Holy Name. Music from the Tower, John Romeri, and Relevant Radio. Please stay tuned.
You're listening to Music from the Tower on Relevant Radio.
Underwritten by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Orange.
This is John Romero, Music Director at Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. We are 1 year away from the dedication of our beautiful cathedral, and we have some spectacular concerts available to you. Check them all out at ChristCathedralMusic.org or on our Facebook page, Christ Cathedral Music. We'd love to see you here.
Christ Cathedral Concerts, great music in a sacred place. For tickets, visit ChristCathedralMusic.org.
You are listening to Music from the Tower today here in our beautiful city of Garden Grove at Christ Cathedral Campus. And today we have been just delighting in the music of Richard Prue. And it's all thanks to our guest today, Michael Salehavy. Michael has been studying the works of Richard Prue, certainly a good friend of his for many, many years. I was also privileged to know Richard in many ways. I commissioned some music from him, several pieces, for various occasions.
Published by GIA.
Published by add, GIA. Yes. Even some unpublished things of GIA. He wrote me a beautiful orchestration when Pope John Paul, now St. John Paul, came to St. Louis. We did I Receive the Living God, mm-hmm. and I have this gorgeous little canzona on for strings and based on that beautiful hymn tune, which Richard wrote for that occasion. You know, so many times you could call on Richard, and he would come through with this little gem of, okay, I'm installing Cardinal Burke. Give me something amazing, you know. There were so many times in the liturgy and in the life of the church where if you needed something composed for a great occasion, installation of a new bishop, a dedication of a new church, Richard would do that. He was just a master at, I remember one time I needed something for the Diocese of Youngstown. They were installing a bishop who was coming from Pittsburgh. He wrote this incredibly beautiful piece, and it was so simple the choir could learn it within mm-hmm. a few weeks, but yet it sounded like $1 million. You know, he was just a master composer, knew the liturgy inside and out. I first met Richard through the Catholic Cathedral Musicians, which he helped found
yes.
and held us all to the highest standards possible. He was a frightening man and a dear man, all in the same, you know, you'd say something and he'd give you the look and you'd think, oh my gosh, I should never have said that in the presence of Richard Prue. But now we're going to go to his life in Chicago. And that's, you've already alluded to the fact that he was at the Cathedral of Holy Name and really was the model cathedral for every one of us in cathedrals. And part of that was through the Cathedral Association. You know, I mean, we got to know him there. He brought things to us. He gave us classes on chant. He gave us just classes on, we talked once about the Chrism Mass and what that meant. And, you know, he instructed all of us, kind of up and coming cathedral musicians, as to just the way liturgy should be. You know, he knew his staff. He was happy to impart it.
Yeah, Richard came to the cathedral in Chicago in 1980. Now, someplace in the mid-70s, he started doing workshops with GIA based on the success of his community mass and other anthems. Bob Battistini, Father Bob Oldershaw, a priest of the Archdiocese of Chicago, who was director of music for the Archdiocese, were doing workshops across the country. Well, in the late 70s, the cathedral began search for a new music director, largely under the vision of the cathedral rector, Timothy Line, who later became Bishop Timothy Line, auxiliary bishop of the Archdiocese. And sure enough, in 1980, Richard was appointed music director for the cathedral, and he was there until 1994. And as you mentioned, it really became a model for cathedrals across the country. The cathedral in Chicago occupies a unique status of being a vibrant cathedral family, as well as being just a block or two off the magnificent mile, the heart of tourist country right. in Chicago. So here's Richard every weekend needing to address the needs of a parish family, address the needs of visitors who needed to be able to instantly participate in music as visitors, trying to hold up exceptional standards in quality in music and text.
But
and
yet,
performance, and he succeeded.
You can't teach them pieces because you're never going to see them again in your life. You know, it's something that many of us face in Center City cathedrals. I'm not in one now. I'm way out here in the suburbs. And, you know, it's a whole different deal. When I was in Philadelphia and in St. Louis, the room was primarily visitors. You know, you had parishioners, maybe 400 or 500, but not like 12,000 that I've got right now. But you had people from trade shows and conventions and, you know, visitors to historic places like Philadelphia. And how do you build a repertoire? Do you just sing Joyful, Joyful every Sunday? Or can you really branch out? Richard knew how to do that better than any of us.
Yeah, and that's demonstrated in a couple of ways. He's got a number of mass settings where he cleverly took familiar melodies, the O Come, O Come, Emmanuel melody, and crafted a mass called Misa Emmanuel, where all of the congregation responses were based on a melody that they already knew. He did the same with the Adoro Te chant, and also the Easter hymn, O Sons and Daughters. He also succeeded by crafting short, engaging, memorable refrains that a congregation could hear once and just repeat, because it was so naturally composed. So the fact that he was a composer writing for a living, breathing congregation is everything.
Yeah.
This wasn't someone purely writing for art's sake. He was writing for a very specific task, and that task was to get a congregation to sing. And he succeeded.
And, you know, you could take a simple melody, whether it's a psalm refrain or a little communion antiphon, whatever it is, and just play that melody and you think, wow, that's easy. It's simple. Anybody could repeat that. And if you harmonize it yourself, you'd put an F chord in or a C chord or a 1 or a 5 or a 4. But if you then went to the accompaniment that Richard wrote, you'd have these lush harmonies and these gorgeous things going on, going places where you would never have guessed. You know, taking that simple melody and enhancing it with the richness that only Richard could do.
Right. Looking at the bottom of your hymnal pages, you'll constantly see the name Richard Prue for his solid standard harmonizations and accompaniments. And yet, as you mentioned, just taking that same little amen or alleluia and doing marvelous spin-offs on it. So these little choral tour de forces that just enhanced and embellished the congregation song.
Well, Richard developed his cathedral singers, which we've been enjoying listening to. He also, of course, put in these fantastic organs in the cathedral. Did he also put in the cassavant? But he put in the flintrop.
He put in both of the organs. There was a rather large pipe organ in the back of the Holy Name Cathedral. The cathedral always suffered from poor acoustics.
Very poor acoustics. So dead.
A beautiful wooden ceiling, which probably added to that some carpeting. So it was never a gracious building for congregational singing, but he continued to work on that. So, yes, he put the cassavant organ in the sanctuary. The sanctuary was marble, and that got the sound out into the room a little bit. And that was a small instrument, but effective for leading congregational song. And then he installed a rather large, significant flintrop, a Dutch builder organ in the loft. And there, you know, Richard also sought to craft an organ that was not only the cathedrals, but the cities. You know, if I can, being a Chicago native, I guess I can say this. I don't think people are going to claim Chicago as a great organ town, okay? Mm-hmm. So Richard said, no, the city needs to have an organ like this that is not only supporting the cathedral's worship, but the Chicago musical community at large. So a very significant instrument, And that was a real pride and joy for him. Richard, we've not even mentioned that he was an accomplished organist, a fine organist. And he certainly knew his way.
You know, I mean, he was also a choral clinician all over the country. I brought him to Pittsburgh. I brought him to St. Louis. I brought him, everywhere we could drag him, we dragged him, because everybody wanted to work with Richard, be under his, even if it's just a few hours and then a concert, whatever it was. Richard was somebody everybody knew and loved and feared. It was like, oh my gosh, is it going to be okay? As we're preparing these choirs, that we, you know, saying to them, when he gets here, he better love what you're doing, because it'll come right back on me.
But invariably, he was a most gracious and effective festival leader, and he had those singers in the palm of his hand. He knew how to make them strive for more and to execute, but he was also the master of one-liners and lighthearted moments that would so relax a group of singers who maybe weren't used to working with someone that demanding and of that stature. But he was a very effective presence in a choir rehearsal setting.
Well, we just briefly touched on the fact that he wrote some gorgeous arrangements of hymns, certainly wrote a couple for me that I commissioned. But this final piece of music we're going to hear today is a setting of Crown Hymn with Many Crowns, a fabulous hymn tune that we all know. But this is a gigantic concertato that he wrote on top of it.
Right. This actually dates from 1968, right before he went to Seattle. And this was written for the Basilica of Mary in Minneapolis, a magnificent building in Minneapolis. And I wanted to make sure that we ended with this because it is congregational song. And once again, above all things, Richard believed in the power of congregational song. Although he had skilled, trained choirs, the congregation would have been his favorite choir every weekend. And so I wanted to make sure we had an example of how he could elevate the experience of congregational singing by surrounding the congregational song with this marvelous brass and organ and percussion and choral elaboration.
Well, Michael, thank you for being with us. We've just barely begun to scratch the surface on our dear friend Richard, but what a great show to be able to talk about this man and all that he continues to do for the church music of America through the music which he left us. So, Michael, thank you for being with us. Hope you'll be back on Music from the Tower soon. We'll talk about lots more things, I'm certain. Thanks for sharing a bit to us about GIA Company and all your work there. And this has been Music from the Tower. Again, I encourage you, I beg you, to go out and listen to great music in live performance everywhere you can. Until next time, this is John Romero and Music from the Tower. Thank you for being with us today. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
won't end.